confrontation between nuclear-armed states. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned about a real danger of World War III breaking out. In his comments to Russian media outlets, Lavrov added that given the current tensions between Russia and the West, the danger of a World War III was, quote, real. Lavrov also criticized Ukraine's approach to the talks and said if negotiations do not move in a reciprocal way, the negotiation process will be hampered. Lavrov also accused NATO of engaging in a war with Russia through a proxy.
I think that the U.S. and their allies have been pushing the world towards a sort of World War III or even a new Cold War mentality for months and even years now, with the kind of propaganda and various official lines that the United States and their closest allies like Great Britain, France, and Germany have been pushing against Russia.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba has criticized his Russian counterpart for warning of a real danger of World War III, saying Lavrov's comments indicated that, quote, Moscow senses defeat. Lavrov's warning came after the U.S. pledged more aid to Ukraine. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken paid a top-secret visit to Kyiv on Sunday and promised to supply more arms to Ukraine.
And I think that the NATO encroachments and the furthering of NATO interests throughout Europe as they get closer and closer to Russia's borders justifies some reaction from Russia. And the United States is going to continue pushing in their interest, which is only going to get us closer to World War III.
Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in the Kremlin on Tuesday for talks revolving around the Ukrainian crisis. Putin said Moscow's move to recognize the breakaway republics of Donetsk and Luhansk was based on the Kosovo precedent set up by a UN-backed court. Following the meeting, the UN said Russian President agreed in principle to UN involvement in evacuations of civilians from Azovstal steel plant. Meanwhile, dozens of U.S. allies met in Germany to bolster Ukraine's military. Traditionally neutral countries of Sweden and Finland are also taking part in the meeting. The conference secured pledges from allies to sustain aid to Ukraine's military throughout this next phase of the war and beyond. The meeting saw a major pledge from Germany, which said it would deliver tanks to Ukraine in a radical switch in policy on the supply of military equipment to the country. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin added, the conference would transform into a monthly contact group on Ukraine's self-defense. According to a Pentagon official, at least 18 of the 19 towed artillery pieces Washington promised in the past 2 weeks have already been delivered to Ukrainian forces, and more are being rushed this week. In addition, Washington is supplying nearly 200,000 rounds of howitzer ammunition and is arranging for ammunition supplies for the Russian-made artillery that Ukrainian forces currently operate. France is sending its ultra-advanced Caesar mobile howitzer, and the Czech Republic is delivering its older self-propelled howitzers. Canada, too, is sending howitzers and advanced guided Excalibur shells that can travel more than 40 kilometers and deliver munitions precisely on target. The UK, on the other side, said it will send Stormer armored vehicles carrying anti-missile launchers to Kyiv. British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the country is also looking to provide Ukraine with long-range artillery and ammunition, as well as anti-ship missiles.
So, I believe there is a limit to how far these countries will allow the United States to use them. And I think that when it comes to threats of nuclear war or the risk of a, you know, all-out World War III with Russia, I do think that we're going to see states in Europe start to stand up to that U.S. imperialism and try and go against them, maybe even allying with Russia themselves.
The European Commission insists that arming Ukraine is not about prolonging the conflict. However, a growing number of civil society organizations and lawmakers in the European countries believe the West should be prioritizing peace talks over arms delivery. Moscow has warned Western countries of the unpredictable consequences for arming Ukraine. Russia says it views Western military supplies to Ukraine as legitimate targets.
Israel is stepping up its atrocities against Palestinians. Israeli forces have shot and killed a young Palestinian man in Jenin. The man was identified as 21-year-old Ahmed Mohammed Lutfi Massad. He was a resident of the town of Burkin. who was killed during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the early hours of Wednesday. Officials say Mossad had been shot in the head. Three other Palestinians with moderate wounds were transferred to the medical facility as well. The Israeli troops broke into dozens of homes and violently searched them, causing excessive property damage before detaining at least three Palestinians. Mossad's death follows that of another Palestinian killed on Tuesday when Israeli forces stormed a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. 20-year-old Ahmed Ibrahim Uwaidat was killed during the shooting in Akabat Jaber camp near Ariha. Nearly 50 Palestinians have been killed by Israelis since the start of 2022. Jenin has become the target of increasing Israeli military raids, arrests, and targeted assassinations in an attempt to crack down on growing Palestinian armed resistance there. The regime in Tel Aviv has escalated its crackdown on Palestinians since the beginning of the Muslim holy fasting month of Ramadan. It has also arrested dozens of Palestinians in the occupied East Al-Quds and desecrated Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Well, I think clearly Israel is trying to provoke the Palestinians. You know, this is just part of their long-term campaign of wanting to take more and more land from the Palestinians. To take over holy sites in Jerusalem that they want for themselves. And again, they're trying to provoke a response that would justify a greater military incursion, I think, into places like the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Damascus Gate.
The regime has further imposed new restrictions on the Palestinian people's entry into the mosque and ordered the demolition of Palestinian homes and agricultural facilities. There are fears of a possible large-scale Israeli invasion of Jenin camp. The armed wings of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Fatah movements are active there. Last week, settler incursions under police protection led to daily confrontations with Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Many Palestinians were injured and arrested. The Palestinian resistance movement of Hamas has also harshly warned Israel against further atrocities against Palestinian people. Hamas says Israeli threats would not discourage the Palestinian people from keeping up their legitimate struggle against the occupying regime.
Well, again, I think Israel's plan is to take over all of Palestine, to push the Palestinians farther and farther out of, in particular, the West Bank, but also Gaza. I mean, it's really a genocidal plan, right? I mean, the plan is either to starve out the Palestinians, force them to leave as refugees, as many have, so that Israel can take over the entire, piece of land there.
The heightened tensions come as people around the world are gearing up for Quds Day rallies around the world. The annual event is held on the last Friday of Ramadan. It was initiated by the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, in 1979 to express solidarity with Palestinians and staunch opposition to Zionism. Palestinians have called on Muslim nations to play a more assertive role in securing the cessation of the Israeli regime's occupation.
The Israeli-Russian ties have been deteriorating rapidly over the past few weeks. Most recently, Russia's ambassador to Israel, Anatoly Viktorov, has warned that Moscow will introduce retaliatory measures against Israel in case the Tel Aviv regime supplies Ukraine with military equipment and aid amid the military conflict there. Viktorov issued the warning in a televised interview on Thursday. It was not immediately clear from the Russian envoy's remarks what such a response might entail.
And I think that we'll see strengthening of cooperation and increased military support for Syria and other regional partners of Russia in the region if Israel goes along with supporting Ukraine. And it's important to note that Ukraine has said that it wants to be in Israel. It wants to be Israel in Europe. It doesn't want to be absolutely liberal and European.
The comments came a day after the Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Israel will provide Ukraine with helmets and flak jackets. Last week, the Russian Foreign Ministry summoned Israeli ambassador to Moscow after Tel Aviv denounced Russia's military operation in Ukraine. It came after the Israeli foreign minister accused Russia of committing war crimes in Ukraine, alleging that there was no justification for Russia's military campaign against its western neighbor. Earlier this month, the Israeli regime voted in favor of a United Nations General Assembly resolution suspending the Russian Federation's membership in the UN Human Rights Council. The move was made over claims of gross and systematic violations and abuses of human rights in Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry called the resolution, quote, unlawful and politically motivated. Taking a sideswipe at Israel and the United States, the Russian Foreign Ministry has said that the longest occupation in the post-war history is being carried out by Israel with the tacit approval of the West. The ministry further bashed the blockade of the besieged Gaza Strip, which Israel says is needed to prevent arms from reaching the Palestinian resistance movements in the enclave.
Well, one of the things that it's important is that Israel saying that Russia has committed war crimes is laughable, since Israel itself has been liable and the charges are severe to their war crimes and human rights violations against the Palestinian people, most recently in the war on the people of Gaza just last year in 2021.
Ukraine has asked Israel for weapons and equipment, including the Iron Dome missile system, something that Tel Aviv hasn't publicly approved so far. Russia has said that foreign weapons sent to Ukraine will be fair game for its military attacks. If Israel decides to sell arms to Russia's western neighbor, will there be a conflict between the two?
So I think it's not yet sure what's happening, but I think what we are seeing is a shift of Israel from being neutral in this current special military operation to openly supporting Ukraine. So it might shift, but it will cost them. It'll cost them heavily because Russia is an important player in Israel-Palestine.
Since Russian President Vladimir Putin announced a special military operation in Ukraine on February 24 and officially recognized the breakaway regions of Luhansk and Donetsk as two republics, the political lines across the globe have been getting redrawn. As Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned, that risks the situation spiraling into a third world war.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, you will discuss issues, relevant questions, and other fields regarding the Islamic upbringing of children. And we would like to stress that the answers that we provide in this program are all based upon the narrations of the household of the Prophet and, of course, of the Prophet himself, and upon the Holy Quran, supplemented with scientific research. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Ali Himani, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for joining us.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's my pleasure to be here in your studio. Today, dear Sheikh, I would like to talk to you about this very, perhaps strange phenomena we find in teenagers who are growing up. And that is, you find these teenagers wearing some of the most strange and outrageous clothing, like you can imagine. Like, even if I say spiky hair, somebody's going to run up and say, I've seen worse. But at least spiky hair, torn jeans, or maybe they only wear black and they also put makeup on their faces and fingernails and, you know, these trends that are...
The gothics.
The gothics, the emo punks and all that. So what's up with that?
This is, again, one of the characteristics that that exist in the teenage group by itself, right?
Right, yeah.
And the characteristic is being focused upon themselves, right? They're focused upon themselves rather than others. They're more focused on, like we mentioned, they're focused upon their own thoughts. Like they're focused upon
pleasing
their
themselves,
own,
you mean?
Not pleasing themselves, trying to find themselves. I always bring this back to the establishing their personality type. So they're trying to figure out their own thought processes. What do I think? What am I more inclined towards? What subjects do I like? Am I into science? Am I into maths? Am I into arts? And then from not just the logic and psychological and mental self-focused and self-centrism where they're trying to explore themselves, but also physically they're focused upon themselves because the never really paid attention to their body, but suddenly you see when they enter teenage, there are physical changes happening in them. Apart from the hormonal changes, apart from the puberty and all other things, they start noticing that their physical facial features are changing. Now the eyes are looking different, nose is growing a little more, lips are turning pinkish, or ears are growing bigger and start growing mustache and beard and stuff like that.
Right.
Now they start paying attention to themselves, and you will find girls particularly spending a lot of time in front of the mirror. Why? Because they never paid attention to themselves earlier, but now they're going through some physical changes, and now they start comparing themselves with others, not from the point of view of their thought structure and their ideologies, but also from their physical structures.
Their appearances.
That right. What looks good on me? Does this color look good on me? Should I wear eyelashes? Should I wear eyeliner? Should I wear lip balm? Should I wear lip lash? All those things, you know, makeup, to what extent, what kind of a dress, toned jeans, untoned jeans, purple color, blue color.
So is their appearance, dear Sheikh, based upon the social norms in a society, you would say?
See, every society has its own social norms. But again, there's this element that we discussed in the earlier section, that the element of, if you don't listen to me, I am not going to listen to you. Therefore,
what?
If you tell me not to break rules, I am going to break rules. So if you tell me that a decent dressing is a jeans which is not torn, I'm going to wear a torn jeans. Why? Because you're not acknowledging me. I'm not going to acknowledge you. If you say a decent hairstyle is to comb your hair, I'm going to wear spiky hairs. Why? Because you don't respect me by not listening to me, by not giving me that respect and understanding. And I'm going to do the exact same with you, counter it with that same behavior.
Right. With that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Sheikh, just before we went on a break, we were talking about one of the reasons why these teenagers, they dress in such a fashionista, outrageous, avant-garde, whatever you want to call it, manner, is because they're lashing out against not being heard or listened to. Would you also say, because humans, they are social creatures, they want to find cliques and people they click with? You mentioned if
Correct.
They love science,
Correct.
They're going to dress like Correct. With the T-shirts with slogans that are scientific or some insider jokes, and then they change their appearance, right?
Correct. It's not just about clicking, but it is also about being attractive enough to be part of the group.
Attractive. Right? Do you mean physical appearance?
Physically attractive. Okay. And that's why you will find the girls and the boys, both of them, experimenting with their clothing styles. Sometimes they want to wear the X kind of a shoe. Then they would want to wear low-waist jeans.
Right.
And, you know, high heels. All that combinations, right, until they arrive at a conclusion that, oh, look, this kind of a t-shirt with this kind of a jeans looks good on me. Others might tell you, you look like a fool, but for him, he's like, I look good. So for him, his own opinion, his own understanding of himself matters a lot more than what others have to say. So I remember one of my friend, he tried jeans, t-shirts, spiky hairs, long hairs, and then he finally arrived at a conclusion that I want to wear the normal hair, but my dressing style would be that I would wear jeans, and I would wear a professional shirt that someone would wear to office when they go to work.
Right.
So he would buy those white and light blue shirts, and then he would wear a tie, which would be, you know, pulled out, like, you know, you pull off your tie at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of dressing he would wear. And people would say that you look stupid. And like, no, I look cool. And
he was an office worker in essence.
He was a teenager, but he wanted to look grown up, you know, coming back from office with his tie pulled down. And he would spend money on buying different ties. At least he had a collection of 16 to 18 ties. Imagine a teenager who's a 17-year-old having 18 ties. Not going to work at all, but he's like, I look cool in this. So he gave more importance to his own opinion than to others' opinion.
And about giving more importance and valuing their own opinion, at least in regards to their appearance, more than others, when we say others, isn't just others who are older than them?
Exactly. You rightly pointed out. I just realized when I said others, I was including a lot of people.
Because they value the opinion of their
age groups. That, you know, the same age group, if they tell them you're looking stupid, they would change.
That's the seal of approval.
And this brings back us to that point that which you mentioned, to click among the group, to associate with them, to be part of a social
construction.
Correct. Social structure of their own age group. So they will try and comb their hairs in a particular style that everybody else approves of. They would dress in a way that everybody else approves of. The eyeliners, the lip lashes, everything is based on what everybody else likes around.
Let's go ahead and take a quick break, dear Sheikh.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
إمام الصادق عليه السلام said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Now, Sheikh, just before we went on a break, we said that teenagers, they value their own opinion more than what others say. When we say others, we mean the older grown-up,
older generations
and so on and so forth. But for me, when you say that they value their own opinions on certain matters, at least about dress and appearance, I see it as perhaps a golden opportunity for Muslim parents to instill the Islamic dress values and dress codes, wouldn't you say?
That would be an amazing step to take, but here's a major challenge, you know. Imagine the parents trying to instill Islamic dressing style, and imagine hijab, right? So they're trying to instill hijab in the girl, but when she goes to school, there's so much peer pressure from the friends around that they have their hair, you know, left open, someone's coloring their hair, someone's wearing, little beads in their hair or butterflies in their hair, and everyone's got a different style, and everyone's showing off their hair and making more friends because they look more beautiful with that kind of a hairstyle, so on and so forth. And these people are so much under pressure that, you know, they have their hair hidden. They don't, they can't wear makeup according to Islam. No adornments, no jewelry, no bracelets.
It is very tough to be a religious Muslim
exactly.
in a non-Islamic country.
Exactly. So I don't see it as a golden opportunity here, but I would definitely say that the parents need to learn how to manage the situation, because you would have girls wearing torn jeans and tight tops, and we are telling our daughters not to look like them because it is not appropriate according to Islam, and they have this constant being laughed upon, peer pressure, including teachers. I had a case where one of the parents approached me and said, what do I tell my child? You know, she comes back home, she's just a 6-year-old or 7-year-old kid, and she comes back home and says, my teacher tells me that, look, all the girls in the class, they have beautiful hair and they're showing their beautiful hair. Don't you feel like showing your beautiful hair to us?
Wow.
And this girl is like, what do I do? I do want to show my hair, but on the other hand, so is Islam really a religion of freedom? It's not giving me the freedom to show my hair. So is there really freedom in Islam? That's the kind of psychological
right.
pressure that is being built upon children
right.
right from that age of 6, 7. One might question that, why is a 7-year-old girl wearing hijab? Because if you wait till they reach puberty and bulugh and that time of wujubat, and then you say, now wear hijab,
right.
that's not going to happen. You got to train them a little before. So there's a lot of psychological pressure that is built on the children right from that age. Someone might question that, why does a 7-year-old girl need to wear hijab? Like I mentioned, waiting till they reach puberty,
right.
that is too late to start hijab. They're going to come back and say, no, we're not going to wear hijab, especially when they're 9. You got to train them when they're 6, slowly, you know, giving them that freedom. Wear
right.
it, don't wear it, it's up to you.
You want to make use of this phase where they're very
exactly.
stubborn, where they do not care about the opinions of others.
Exactly. So you need
right.
to mold them before that.
Yeah.
So right from age 6, you start training them till they reach 9. They're already adjusted to wearing hijab regularly, every day, every hour, and then it becomes comfortable. So like you mentioned, it's a golden opportunity. No, I wouldn't say golden opportunity, but I would definitely want to bring the point that pay special attention here. Learn how to handle the situation and manage it well. If you don't manage it well, it's going to backfire. And this very rebellious behavior from the child is going to lead you into the element where she's going to say, I'm not doing hijab anymore. Rather, I'm not Muslim at all, right?
Right.
And that's how it might backfire. So you should know how to deal with this scenario.
Sheikh, would you say then perhaps that it is, if not impossible, very difficult to raise a religious, conservative Muslim girl in a Western society?
I don't want to call them conservative. See, somewhere, I don't know why people categorize them radical,
when
conservative.
When I say conservative, is because I do not want to include the liberals.
I know, I understand.
Very liberal with how they dress.
I understand, but,
right.
but Islam does not categorize that way. Islam says you're either Muslim or not
right.
Muslim.
Islam is
so
Islam.
Either exactly.
Yeah.
Either you're following it or you're not following it. Islam is a package by itself.
Yeah.
You can't say it's like a buffet lunch. I pick some part and leave some part. So if you are a Muslim, don't think it's so much more challenging, you know, the way we put it, especially when we say radical, conservative, that's when it becomes difficult. But if you say he's a Muslim and here are the things they need to follow, I don't think there's much of a challenge. Yes, there is difficulty, but I wouldn't say impossible. There are always ways and methods, and it can be easily achieved, inshallah.
And keeping that in mind, we will have to end today's program. I thank you for contributing to this discussion, and also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback, or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
In the limelight. The Persian Gulf National Day, which the Islamic Republic of Iran marks every year on 10th of Iranian month of Ordibehesht, April 30, reminds Iranians and the world of the importance of this strategic waterway. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is titled, Persian Gulf Security Warrants No Entry to Israeli Regime. Stay tuned for more. The Persian Gulf National Day, which the Islamic Republic of Iran marks every year on the 10th of the Iranian month of Ordibehesht, April 30, reminds Iranians and the world of the importance of this strategic waterway. Iran has the largest coastline stretching across the entire northern shores of the Persian Gulf, and hence, from time immemorial, the identity of this body of water through which over 25% of the world's current crude oil supplies pass has been Persian. On the southern shores of the Persian Gulf are the coastlines of six Arab states, including Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, the UAE, and Oman, while on its east is Iraq's narrow access to international waters. The Persian Gulf covers an area of 251,000 square kilometers and is connected to the Gulf of Oman in the east by the Strait of Hormuz, while its western end is marked by the major river delta of Arvandrud, which carries the waters of the Euphrates and Tigris. The length of the Persian Gulf is 989 kilometers. Its maximum depth is 90 meters, and it contains a rich variety of marine life, including plants and fishes, the largest of which are the dolphins and the sea cows, while occasionally sharks venture into the area. The Persian Gulf and its littoral possess two-thirds of the world's estimated oil reserves. Hence, the area is dominated by petrochemical and related industries. In addition, there are large gas fields in these waters, with Qatar and Iran sharing a giant field across the territorial median line. North Field in the Qatari sector, South Pars Field in the Iranian sector. These factors have increased the importance of safeguarding the security of this vital arm of the Indian Ocean, as well as protection of its fragile ecology that risks being damaged by oil spills. ROPME, or the Regional Organization for Protection of the Marine Environment of the Persian Gulf, is the only bloc that is made up of all eight Persian Gulf countries. Unfortunately, due to the divisive policies of the West, which since the colonial times has been interfering in the Persian Gulf, the unrepresentative and unelected regimes of the region have allowed the Americans to establish foothold in the area. Of late, certain regimes like the Ali Nahyan of Abu Dhabi and the repressive Ali Khalifa minority clan have made the grave mistake of setting up diplomatic ties with the illegal Zionist entity and thus providing access to Persian Gulf waters for the Israeli regime usurpers of Palestine. This is nothing but treason. And the Islamic Republic of Iran, as the paramount power of the region, has already served notice that any harm to the interests of Iran and the Iranian people will result in a devastating response aimed at the heart of Israel. We'll be right back. The warning is thus loud and clear. Iran, as the principal supporter of the rights of the Palestinian people and the Campaign for the Liberation of Islam's former Qibla, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, in the Zionist-occupied Islamic city of Beit al-Muqaddas, will certainly not allow the Israelis to spread their tentacles in the Persian Gulf. It is still not too late for all the Persian Gulf countries to overcome their petty differences and work together for peace and security in the interests of Islam and the Muslims of the region.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, social life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the social lifestyle in the Islamic lifestyle or the social aspect of the Islamic lifestyle. We know that as a human being, we need to live in a society, and the thing which differs between the human beings and the animals is that the human beings, they live in a society, they socialize with the people, and the way they socialize, animals do not do. We can see that, for example, even if there are a group of animals which some might say they also have a social life, they live with the family, they live with the kids, for example, the family of lions or the other animals. But the difference is that we can see that they never had any kind of advancements in their life. Whereas human beings, when they're living in a family, they have changed. Their lifestyle is being changed, and there is an advancement in the life. Therefore, this is what we see, that because human beings are socializing or social animals, the way we say, so the difference between the human beings and the animals is that the human beings, they socialize. Therefore, Islam has paid attention to this social aspect of the lifestyle, and it gives an order to have a good relation with the parents, with the neighbors, with the people in the society, at the place where we work. Therefore, we need to be very much careful. And on top of that, when we talk about the society, we must be careful about the society. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the social aspect of Islamic lifestyle, and we said that because human beings are the social animals and they socialize, therefore they must be careful when they're socializing in the society. Now, when we look at the Islamic teachings, there is something which is being said, and that is that when you're living in a society and when you have the money and the power, or maybe if you're related to a political, group, or you have become an important person, therefore you must be humble, you must show humbleness, and do not show arrogance towards people. Do not be arrogant, because shaitan or the iblis or evil or Satan was the first person who became arrogant when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said to him to socialize with the human beings and to prostrate to Adam alayhi salam. So the Quran says, Aba wastakbara wa kana min al-kafirin, that he denied to do that, and then he became, obviously, he denied to do that because of the arrogancy. وَاسْتَكْبَرَ وَكَانَ مِنَ الْكَافِرِينَ, and he was from the disbelievers. Therefore, we need to be humble when we are dealing with each other, when we are having relation with each other, when we are talking to each other. Therefore, we need to be humble to each other. We need to be downwards when we are talking to each other, when we are socializing with each other, so that the love comes between us, so that the love spreads amongst the people, and so that we do not have disputes. In order to ignore the disputes and be away from the disputes, it is necessary to be humble, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The limelight.
The injustice of homelessness, a human rights crisis of immense proportions in the United States, is on stark display in Idaho's modestly sized capital of Boise, just as it is across the nation. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Tyler Valick, reporter. This article is published under the heading Occupy Style Protest in Boise Highlights Brutal Conditions Faced by the Unhoused in the U.S. Here's the story. The injustice of homelessness, a human rights crisis of immense proportions in the United States, is on stark display in Idaho's modestly sized capital of Boise, just as it is across the United States. While the city might not come to mind when one envisions the sprawling atrocity of homelessness, it is a 2018 court battle originating in Boise that has had a defining influence on homelessness policy far beyond the Idaho border. After passing ordinances that targeted the city's population of people experiencing homelessness, the city of Boise faced a court challenge from six unhoused plaintiffs. The outcome was Martin v. City of Boise, a landmark 2018 ruling by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that barred the criminalization conducting life-sustaining activities on the streets in the absence of alternative shelter. Although advocates had reason to cheer this apparent progress, the decision has ultimately served more as a reiteration of their moral claims than as a practical guarantor of the rights of the unhoused. Evasion of Martins versus Boise mandate has been the norm in cities within the court's broad remit. This is just as much the case in Boise itself, where the city has found numerous ways to violate the spirit, if not the letter, of the Ninth Circuit decision, perpetuating the kinds of criminalization, displacement, and harassment that are favored responses of power to the plight of marginalized people. In the frigid winter, the mistreatment of both thousands of unhoused people has only intensified, according to activists. Housing remains scarce and unaffordable, while overcrowding and restrictions in shelters have kept many on the street and acute hardship. Local advocates, organizers with BOA Mutual Aid and members of the unhoused have responded by joining together in coalition, spearheading an Occupy-style protest on the grounds of the Idaho State Capitol Mall. Now, over a month in, they have dealt with dismal conditions and repeated provocations from police and the far right alike. Bella Bounty, an organizer with BOA Mutual Aid, who asked to be identified by a pseudonym to avoid attention from the state and the far right, told reporters that in the last couple of years, activists observed something which has really escalated since Martin versus BOA. Constant police harassment, tickets for offenses are handed out freely. Those unable to challenge their citations are often later arrested, held on failure to appear warrants. It's a punishing cycle that ensures their impoverishment. Police also profile and target people living in cars and order their vehicles to be ticketed and towed. Unable to pay the lot fees, many people lose their only shelter as a result. John Rogers, who has been on the streets in BOA since arriving from Louisiana in 2016, alleges systematic persecution in the legal system in the United States. They had come to arrest you, trump the charges up, make you pay an exorbitant amount of bail to get out. But when you go to court, guess what? They drop it. Or they drop it to a lesser offense, much lesser. So you're not gonna contest it. You're gonna take your lick, Rogers told reporters, adding, you can't do anything about it because now it's on your own record. They're just stealing your money. It's extortion. Members of the unhoused community in BOA are all too familiar with these kinds of torments. Teddy B is a veteran and one-time homeowner from Missouri who asked to be identified by his surname's initial. He has been unhoused in BOA for 2.5 years and has faced longer stints on the street in his past. He said bitterly, my experience with the police has been pure harassment. Almost daily they come down and confiscate sleeping bags, propane heaters, blankets, pillows. They have taken my dog's service vest. They have taken multiple sleeping bags. They took a whole backpack of the stuff. If I were to act the way the BOA troopers and the state police of Idaho act when I was in the Marine Corps overseas, I would still be in the brig for it, he said, suggesting that he believed such behavior would have been landed him in military prison. Lone campers forced to hide from police face an increased risk of assault as well as hypothermia. In the winter, they must choose between the lethal cold and the very real dangers posed by heater fumes and tent fires. And community members allege when police come upon the unhoused people, they often relentlessly ransack their tents and confiscate all belongings, including cold weather gear, which in Idaho winter can have serious consequences. Search and seizure rights seem to be no deterrent, say local members of the unhoused. The reason they don't need a warrant is they call it a welfare check, Teddy B says, claiming that cops often attempt to check the welfare of the unoccupied tents, which they then throw in a dumpster. Then he alleges the BOA police sit and wait around the corner for nighttime for you to come to retrieve your stuff, and they charge you with a crime there. It's ridiculous. The system is designed to turn you into a criminal. Rogers described similar harassment, saying they have been known to take people's personal belongings and throw them in the street. ¶¶
a diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Eid al-Fitr, the Eid of struggling to form a unified Muslim nation. May 25, 2020. The month of Ramadan, which is full of divine blessings for our nation and other Muslims, is over, and many happy people benefited from the blessings of this month. These people spent the day obeying God while they were fasting, and while they felt hungry and thirsty in such hot weather and on such hot days, and they avoided carnal desires and curbed the human passions. At night, many people engaged in prayer and dhikr, and they kept a vigil for God. Those who carried out their responsibility by worshipping God and fulfilling divine obligations in this month feel satisfied and happy. Engaging in spiritual deeds and fighting against human passions in this month gives a feeling of joy and spiritual happiness to you, dear people, who are the masters of determination and willpower and who exercise patience in fasting. One of the characteristics of carrying out responsibilities for the sake of God and making efforts and engaging in jihad for the sake of God is that one feels happy although one endures hardships and difficulties. And God has connected this happiness with the happiness that we feel on the day of Eid al-Fitr in order to show the greatness of this day.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We should ask Allah the Exalted to generously give value to the prayers of our dear people in this month. Oh, he who collects the little that is given to him and shows gratitude for the paltry that is done for him. Oh, he who shows gratitude for the small and rewards with the great. Oh, he who comes close to him, who comes close to him. Oh, he who invites to himself him who turns his back on him. Oh, he who changes not favor and rushes not to vengeance. Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah, dua number 46. This is the dua that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam would recite on a day like this, on Eid al-Fitr, and he would also teach others to recite it. If you take one single step towards Allah the Exalted, he will help you move closer to him. Those who have turned their backs on God and religion, Allah the Exalted invites them to turn to Him out of His mercy and kindness. This is divine mercy and grace. By Allah's favor, our dear youth, who developed certain spiritual characteristics in this month, will preserve these characteristics. By Allah's favor, they will preserve these spiritual characteristics until the end of their lives, or at least until the next month of Ramadan, the next Eid al-Fitr. We should preserve our close bond with the Holy Quran, our attention to God, our involvement in divine remembrance, our presence in the arenas in which Allah the Exalted wants His servants to be present, including the arenas relating to our inner selves, and the arenas relating to the world of Islam, our society and the Islamic Ummah. And Allah the Exalted will bless us.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
For the first time since the presidential election, the Yellow Vests marched around the country, and most expressed disbelief that Emmanuel Macron was re-elected despite his unprecedented repression of the group.
Frankly, we really don't understand how Macron could be re-elected. We started over purchasing power, and it's worse than ever. I guess people need a knife to their throats to come protest anymore?
They were met by a huge police presence, armed to the teeth. The government continues to intimidate yellow vests, but also the average person from rejoining the demonstrations. Intimidating deterrence is also being used to keep journalists from covering the group. In the yellow vest demonstration the day before the first round of voting, a journalist from a top French media was fined for allegedly illegally demonstrating while simply reporting on the yellow vests.
We'll never stop demanding for citizens' referendums, purchasing power, decent pensions, and the ability to have some money left at the end of the month. After the legislative elections in June and the summer vacation, social unrest will explode this fall.
Thousands of devoted yellow vests will continue to turn out every Saturday in Paris alone, and they say others will put their yellow vests back on when they see Macron's plans for his second term.
Emmanuel Macron will continue to be the president of the rich and will continue to march. People will eventually recover their good sense and realize the only way to change politics is to join us in the streets.
Nobody expected the yellow vests to stop marching. Now we'll see if they can last for the next 5 years. Global May Day protests will see establishment forces, such as unions and political parties, march nationwide in favor of workers' rights, but also to express major dissatisfaction with the presidential election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As the month of Ramadan is coming to an end, Muslims are gearing up to pick the best clothes to get dressed up for one of their biggest festivities, Eid al-Fitr, or the Festival of Breakfast. This exhibition gives a glimpse of local costumes of several Muslim countries, from Tunisia and Egypt all the way to Afghanistan and Iran.
On Eid al-Fitr and other important festivities in Tunisia, men wear this white costume and women dress like me or the clothes that you see behind me. They are our traditional clothes.
The shirt this man is wearing is made from a Syrian cloth called the maska. It's a famous Syrian cloth that's made out of silk and cotton. Syrian men wear them in celebrations such as weddings and also during our festivities such as Eid al-Fitr.
Aside from showcasing their costumes, the participating nations